This is Curtis Fox for ACLU.org. On April 26th in New York City, writers and luminaries from around the world gathered for a night of readings to help end torture, arbitrary detention, and secret kidnappings by the U.S. government. The event, entitled Dirty Wars, was sponsored by the ACLU and the Penn American Center as part of the Penn World Voices Festival. In this selection, Nobel laureate and author Nadine Gordimer reads from Scatter the Ashes and Go by South African poet Mangani Wali Sorote.
The war of the apartheid regime against the liberation forces in South Africa was indeed a dirty war. And the kinds of methods that we've been shuddering to hear so far, they were employed against people who were held in detention for weeks, months on end, detention without trial, and also others who indeed were convicted political prisoners. Among them were two poets, Brayton Breytenbach and Jeremy Cronin. We have just heard, of course, Brayton doing what only a poet can do, being able to express the unspeakable because of things that happened to people in the kind of situations we've been hearing. They happened in South Africa and they were unspeakable. The whole question of dirty war, there are many different tactics, not only the terrible, terrifying, obvious ones that we have heard, but others which I think are not without importance. A poet and writer, Mangani Wali Sorote, I'm going to read from his book, Scatter the Ashes and Go. It's a unique book, I think, in a way, because it is written by someone who indeed was in one of the cadres in Umkhonto weSizwe, the Spear of the Nation, the armed wing of the African National Congress. And here you have the matching of the experience with the poets and writers' ability, again, as with Brayton, to express it. He also has, Sorote, the courage to write things that are perhaps better forgotten by many people. And that is what happened to traitors who were placed within the camps themselves, the camps of the freedom fighters, to spy on them. And I'm going to read you a small piece that refers to this. The question is, do you simply condemn, do you spit upon such people who allowed themselves to come from among their own people, black against black in this case, and go into the, get yourself into the Umkhonto weSizwe army to spy on them and very often to kill and certainly to give knowledge of where they were moving, when and how, so that the South African army would then move in to kill them. It's a bit difficult to explain why the main battles of the war, of the Freedom War in South Africa, were fought not within the country. The ANC and its brother and sister organizations for liberation, for obvious reasons, couldn't operate from within the country, couldn't organize. And so this was done from Lusaka, in what is now in Zimbabwe, and the battles were fought in Namibia, in Angola. The South African army just went in after them there. These things he did not know, but now time has taught him. Something which the eyes do or the face does, and something which the shoulders and the body do, give a hint. They hint at it is you who you meet and who you are with. This now he had learnt. It's taken a long time, a lifetime almost, to learn this. It does happen now when he lay dying alone in the bush, that he remembered this. And he smiled. But then it was too late. He then, for some reason, some strange reason, which he could not explain, thought, as he knew that these were the last moments, he just knew it, they were the last moments of his life, he thought that it's necessary that some things are discarded. He wanted to cry, but he could not. Perhaps it is also that, he thought. To die is also to be very busy. He felt like laughing at this thought. Madness does occupy space. It does engage time. It is active, and it is also a form of death. Death is a form of discarding. That is why at the end it is said, ash to ash, dust to dust. But who would say that at his burial? Did he want them to say so? It is strange to think, he thought, that he would have no say in that. There was no chance for him to give his last view about his remains. He tried, as he felt feeble, to recall one of the songs he loved most, a song by Stimela, and then he saw the blue sky and the tall dancing tree. But he also thought about lightning and bullets and the fire. He remained calm and realized that he was longing for life. Because long ago, he had learned certain things from life. These things he began to learn by listening and watching, by asking, and then once he tried it out. He had been here now not so long compared with the others, but he'd grown accustomed to many things which he thought were useless. He was born in Soweto. That's what he said whenever he was asked. Asked further, he said, White City. Many times he longed for White City. He missed it, but also he missed Soweto. And he missed Johannesburg. But also he found himself longing in a painful way for South Africa, home. He had to, at one time, learn how to overcome it. Otherwise it would overcome him. Every day, for a long stretch of time, he felt the weight of every minute of the day. He carried them, as he did his AK-47, which he knew had bullets to kill, and a butt, which, if you put on the pit of his shoulder and chest, gave him sights, which pulled the target to him and made it stay there for him to poke a neat hole into it. This gun does not point at a comrade. That's the voice of his weapons instructor, once said this to him, as he learnt the art of shooting. This muzzle looks at the enemy only, he had said, pulling an oily cloth backwards and forwards through the dark barrel. He walked the footpaths. He went into rivers. He hammered through thick bush and jungle in those days, repeating these words as his hands, as if elastic, insisted that he should level the rifle against those walking with him, pull the trigger, hear the rapid explosion, and then, the voice in him kept saying, to which he recited, this gun does not point at a comrade. This muzzle must eye the enemy only. Daily his hands insisted, and daily he recited his lines. Many times he reached the point of despair. Why not do it, once and for all? And with a great struggle, with great strength, he forced himself to recite the lines. Why must this face him? Why is he the only one to be tempted by treachery? Why him? But no voice answered. So daily he battled. He battled during the long and trying toy jogs up, down hills, over rocks and bush. He battled with this one-person battle. He could share it with no one. He knew what had happened to anyone who would do this. He himself once, when he had just finished his basic training, had to go out with a unit in search of someone who had done this sort of thing. If it were not for the vigilance of comrades, all of them, sleeping in a tent, 20 of them would have been killed. The comrade, no, the bandit. What are people who are treacherous called? Mpimpi? He woke up at night, uncocked his rifle, and started to shoot blindly at the sleeping comrades. Vusi remembered that night very well, as if that was not enough, as he was about to fall asleep. Gunfire shattered the silent night. Automatic gunfire. He dived from the bed to the ground, cocked his rifle, and waited for the next order while he listened to the fire and placed it not very far from his tent. Then the order came. The Impimpi had opened fire and then escaped. The commander gave the order to search for the Impimpi. This gun does not point at a comrade. He lived by this now. Now and then he could feel how other comrades looked at him. They watched him carefully without saying a word. Once one comrade asked him, "Are you sure you're ready to fight the Boers?" It was a condemning question. He can't recall how he replied to it. He carried on collecting firewood and carrying his AK-47. Everything was such an effort to be at the camp, to go to formation, to do physical training, to engage in discussions. He felt looked at and watched. He felt untrusted. Everything was an effort. Then he began to think maybe he must shoot himself. For days he went on, fighting with every bit of strength he had not to do it. He would be alone in the felt toilet when the thought came. He would look at his rifle and fight that his hands do not reach for it. One day it was raining. He went to the toilet. He was relieving himself when the thought struck him. He deliberately picked up the rifle. He had the cocking lever. He put his finger on the trigger, and then, "This gun does not point at a comrade," he said, and he put the gun down.
Thanks for listening to this ACLU podcast. To learn more about the challenges to U.S.-sponsored torture, detention, and extraordinary rendition, go to aclu.org. And for more podcasts, go to aclu.org/podcasts. For aclu.org, I'm Curtis Fox.